MacCast, Monday, April 9th, 2018. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to be back here with you for another episode. Hopefully you are having a nice spring. It's been pretty good here in San Diego, although I have to say I've been caught a little bit in the rat race and probably spending too much time inside, but I did get out over the weekend. Hopefully you had a nice weekend or are having a nice week and are enjoying yourselves. Looking over the notes here, we have a number of things to talk about. Actually, quite a bit going on in the world of Apple and the Macintosh, although we're a little bit in a holding pattern as we wait for Worldwide Developer Conference to come up in June. But there's some rumors floating around. We're going to talk a little bit about Apple maybe expanding their CPU efforts and what that might mean outside of the iOS world. We're going to talk a little bit more, follow up a little bit more on Apple and their micro LED technology. We talked, I think, a little bit about that on the last episode of the MacCast. Apple looking to make Siri maybe a little bit smarter, which is good news for a lot of people. We've got rumors about new iPhones and what might be next for iPhones, and an update on the status of the Mac Pro. And I won't give away too much on that, but you might know a little bit already of how that is going to go. And then we're going to get to some of your feedback. We had an iOS update come out, and some people are saying the HomePod sounds a little bit different. We'll talk about what's going on there and maybe find out if you're experiencing the same thing. A little bit about smart keyboards, follow up on that. Apple doing push updates a little bit too quickly. Are they pushing out OS updates a little bit too quickly? One of you had a question about that. I want to talk about that a little bit. We're going to talk about doing a clean install and Nuke and Pave and why you may or may not want to do that. I'm going to talk a little bit about remote access and Back to My Mac, and then archives and podcast playlists. What happened to those? And maybe give you some ways that you can kind of get that functionality back if you've been missing out on that. So lots of great questions and feedback from you. We're just going to jump right into things, kicking it off this week with a little conversation about Apple CPUs and your Mac. Bloomberg is claiming that Apple is in the early stages of a project they're calling Kalamata. Makes me want to have some nice Greek food, to be honest. But it is supposedly Apple's own processor designs coming to the Mac, they say, as early as 2020. Now, this is not a new rumor by any means. If you've been listening to the MacCast for any amount of time, you know this has cropped up from time to time ever since Apple started making their own processors for iOS, or designing their own processors, if we're being more accurate. And that's sort of what this new rumor is about. It's, you know, sort of the, I call it almost the next logical step for Apple to take their processor design teams and all that knowledge and all the great talent that they have there and start applying that toward Macintosh processors. They've been doing it very successfully with those A-series processors on iOS, so why not do that for the Mac? And there's a lot of good benefits for Apple doing that. Of course, one of the concerns is this is not Apple's forte, at least when it comes to desktops, or you don't think it is, but again, it wasn't their forte when they got into mobile processors either. And more these days, mobile processors are what people want. They want things in tablets. They want things that are low power, low energy consumption, give long battery life, but still have a lot of performance. And that would be one of the major benefits of Apple moving into this market, is they could better control things. They could better control the release cycle of their products. Right now, being dependent on a company like Intel, Apple has to wait for them to make innovations, and they're not coming all that quickly anymore. I don't know if you've noticed, but you know, Intel's iterations are getting smaller and smaller. We're not seeing these quantum leaps in processors. They, you know, really, Moore's law has broken down in terms of just getting raw performance out of processors. They're throwing in more cores and doing what they can, but really, you're not seeing that. So in order to get more performance, Apple's going to need to kind of take the tact that they did with the A-series processor, which is better integration of the hardware and software features. You know, Apple is able to do more with less when it comes to the A-series processors. They use less RAM in iOS devices than competitors. They're running things like Snapdragon processors and things like that. Yet when you look at benchmarks, when you look at real world performance, Apple's combination really outperforms everybody else. So be able to do that in the realm of Macs would be a really good thing. Another thing Apple can do is keep features exclusive, and they can keep a lot of their technology and the things that they're working on in-house and private so that it's not getting stolen and used by their competitors. And so they can gain a leg up there. And of course, everybody wants better battery performance, especially when it comes to notebooks and things like that. And they can control thermal profiles and battery consumption and all those kinds of things. And Apple, in a way, has already brought a number of their processor technologies to the Mac, both in the new Touch Bar MacBook Pros with the S1 processor, I believe it is, and then they've got the S2, or is it the T1 and the T2? I might be getting my acronyms wrong, and I apologize for that. Didn't have that in my show notes, but you get the point. They're making co-processors already for the iMac Pro and for the Touch Bar MacBook Pro, so this would just be sort of extending that, albeit in a much bigger way. And of course, Apple is not going to go into, I guess they could with the cash on hand, but they're not going to go into actual processor manufacturing. They're not going to become an Intel. What they're most likely to do is, again, take the same approach that they've done with the A-series processors, and they will do the chip design and development and the R&D, and then they will take those designs and they'll work with some sort of manufacturing partner. Right now, it's seeming like if Apple does move forward with the Mac processors, and this is by no means a guaranteed thing. This is just all speculation. Apple, you know, I think it's probably not too big of a stretch to think that Apple has Macs running in labs on Apple-designed silicon, on Apple-designed processors, and they're looking forward to actually being able to maybe produce these things. And so they would partner with a company like Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Limited, TSMC. They've done other production for Apple, and they would be a likely candidate. I guess Samsung could also be in there, but I think Apple kind of wants to move away from Samsung as much as possible. But that 2020 timeline, I would say that's probably pretty aggressive. And more likely than not, Apple is going to kind of do this in phases. They're going to roll it out over time. Again, I think starting with some of these co-processors that we've been seeing, moving some of the various specialized heavy lifting tasks in laptops and desktops off onto maybe their designed processors, and then working in conjunction with the desktop processor, and then eventually moving on to doing the actual CPU itself. And I would think that the very first product we would see in terms of what you would consider to be a traditional laptop or desktop machine would be some sort of laptop. And it might even end up being kind of a hybrid or an extension, I would imagine, of an iPad, you know, an iPad style computer, maybe even running iOS with a keyboard. And we do know that Apple has their Project Marzipan, which is going to allow iOS apps. It's a developer thing, going to allow developers to create iOS apps to create apps that will also run natively on the Mac desktop to save them a little bit of development time. So I think we're starting to reach that phase of the crossover. Are we ever going to see a complete merger of iOS and macOS? I think that's not out of the realm of possibility. And would we see this processor being an ARM-based processor like the A-series? I think that's likely as well, although no guarantee. They're not really talking about the technology that would underline a Mac, an Apple-designed, rather, processor. We're just going to have to wait and see what Apple comes up with. But again, I think it's not surprising to anyone that this would be a thought and a direction that Apple is really seriously considering moving in. And it does worry the folks at Intel a little bit. But Intel has been working on their latest generation of processors. They announced the next generation of processors that would be potentially suitable for MacBook Pros. And unfortunately, while they're very nice spec-wise, it does, in essence, illustrate why Apple may be looking to move beyond Intel. They announced the 8th generation processors this week for mobile, including a new A9 variant. So we've had, you know, i3, so it's a new i9 variant. Got that wrong. i3, i5, i7 is what we're currently used to. There is a new i9 variant, but the trouble with these new designs is they still only support LPDDR3 RAM, just like the 2016 and 2017 editions of the MacBook Pro, which means that Apple's not going to be able to max out the RAM beyond 16 gigabytes. That is, unless they want to implement their own controller for DDR4 RAM, and that's possibly going to have a negative impact on battery life. And that was the reason Apple gave for not allowing more RAM in the current generation of Touch Bar MacBook Pro. So, you know, this is the kind of thing that Apple is running into while they're waiting for Intel to innovate, and it's just not happening. And so they're not getting the processors and things that they ultimately probably want for their products, and they may have to turn to their own designs. So that's kind of where we're heading with Mac. And I think, you know, it's going to be very interesting. But Apple has gone through, some people are worried about the transition, but remember, Apple has gone through two different kinds of processor transitions in the past. One way back when, from when they went from, you know, the Apple II to the Mac, and then you also had the Mac transition to Intel, and they handled both of those, I think, fairly well. So I have no doubt in Apple's ability to make the transition. And again, I think in this case, it's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to be, you know, I cut the cord with Intel and suddenly we're on Apple design processors. I think we're going to see a slow transition. And I think expecting it to begin in or around 2020 is likely the case. Another technology we've been talking about Apple moving to is this micro LED technology. Last week, we had some rumors talking about Apple opening up a new facility, R&D facility near their campus. They've acquired a few companies that are focused around the area of micro LED technology. Well, this week, we have Digitimes coming to sort of back up the Bloomberg reports, but add a little more detail and a little more information about where we might see micro LED technology, at least initially. Now, we did allude to when we were talking about the Bloomberg piece that it would likely be an Apple Watch display, and that seems to be confirmed by the Digitimes report. They're claiming that Apple is already kind of working on some designs for a micro LED screen that will be a 1.3 to 1.4 inch panel and would likely come in an Apple Watch. They're saying as soon as in the second half of 2018 or early 2019. Now, Bloomberg had their date more around 2020, and I tend to believe that date a little bit more. I could see it happening maybe with an Apple Watch release in 2019, but I think that would be the very earliest. I don't think we're going to see it this year. Definitely not. I think they need to work on that technology a little bit more. But they claim that Apple is partnering with TSMC again to create micro LED panels with silicone backs. And I have to be careful because I may have said micro OLED, micro LED technology, just in case I got that wrong. Originally, the micro LED technology, they say, might only appear in the top end of Apple Watch. And that is because the panels are expected to cost about 400 to 600% more to produce than similar sized OLED display panels. And they also claim that Apple is potentially ordering or working on 0.7 to 0.8 inch panels, and this would be for an upcoming augmented reality product. And that's something we've been hearing rumored about, is that Apple has various designs and have been playing around with the idea of making some sort of augmented reality display, likely built into a pair of glasses. And so you would need kind of smaller panels for that. So that's where they may be moving with that technology. And we'll just keep on top of the story and keep you updated as it develops. Now, I have to say, and I think we've talked about it on the show in the past, that Siri gets beat up a lot when it comes to tests of artificial intelligence assistance. A lot of people felt that Apple really had the lead in AI when they acquired Siri way back when, but that they've sort of stagnated over the years. I don't wholly share that opinion. I see where some of the deficiencies in Siri are versus things like Amazon Alexa and the Google Smart Home. But overall, you know, I'm a pretty big fan of Siri, and I think it works really well. And I think it's gotten even better in recent years. And part of the reason I think it's getting better and better pretty quickly is Apple has been ramping up its AI team over the years. And just this week, it was announced a major new hire for that team. Apple has stolen away Google's head of AI and search, John Andrea. He has worked on some pretty big projects at Google. He is known as the guy who made the major push to bring AI into the entire suite of products across Google. He was instrumental in developing the knowledge graph feature. That's the feature that drives the direct intelligent answers that you see when you do search results on Google. So that little box to the right that has all that additional information, it looks into your search query and uses AI to bring back a bunch of information. And he was instrumental in making that work. And he is expected to be Apple's head of machine learning and AI strategies, and will impact a number of areas of Apple's business, not just Siri, but also the operating systems and the apps. Apple's building a lot of AI technologies into that. They also have their entire autonomous systems development project, and he's expected to help out in that arena as well. And as you know, a big focus of Apple when it comes to AI is protecting privacy. And Google, let's just be honest, they're not always known for that being their sort of mantra when it comes to your personal information. So some people might have concerns. Well, if they're bringing this guy in from Google, is that going to, you know, make changes at Apple? And Tim Cook had reportedly sent an email to staff, to Apple staff, about the hire. It was leaked to, I believe, the Wall Street Journal. And in that email, he said, quote, "John shares our commitment to privacy and our thoughtful approach as we make computers even smarter and more personal." So hopefully he's going to be able to bring in some of that AI technology and that data mining technology that Apple's able to do on device and in a private manner, and make Siri more robust, be able to do more things while still protecting our security and privacy. And I think, you know, that's Apple's direction they're trying to move in. And I think he can only help in that arena, especially, again, if we want to believe Tim Cook, and he shares that sort of thinking, at least when he gets over to Apple. And it's not just, you know, at the top level that Apple is hiring people. They've been hiring a ton of engineers and looking for a lot of people to work on the Siri team. And also this week, we heard from a site called ThinkNum. They noticed that and have been keeping track of Apple's job listings and which ones have the term Siri in them, where they're specifically hiring and looking for Siri engineers and talent for the Siri team. And they say in the last month, the number of job postings has risen significantly. They've been rising over the past year. And as a matter of fact, just last week, the number of open positions, according to the site, reached an all-time high of 161 different openings. And they say that was up 24% from just last month. So Apple really looking to get in. And I think, I hate to say it, play a little bit of catch up, because I don't think they've really fallen behind. I think they just haven't rolled out as many features. I think they're working a lot on a lot of things, but they're also under a lot more constraints, again, when it comes to security and privacy and keeping the data, you know, in-house and on device and things like that. They have more challenges than some of their competitors do. And I, for one, I think they've done a really great job so far. So I think hiring more people, putting more people on the problem can only help. And hopefully it means we'll start seeing Siri get smarter and more intelligent even faster, because I think it has been improving over the past year, and I expect a lot more of it given what we're seeing in terms of Apple's staffing efforts. I have to admit to you this week that the iPhone rumors that I'm about to talk to you about, I am not super excited about. As a matter of fact, in the show notes, I put the title as, the new iPhones are about to have features that no one wants. And that's being a little bit extreme. We'll find out. And you let me know if these are features that you're particularly interested in. But Mark Gurman over at Bloomberg says that Apple is working on touchless gesture controls and curved screens for future iPhones. He says the technology is at least 2 years off, so we're not going to see it for a little while. But I remember, you know, Samsung, did they try this a little while back? And really, it ended up being nothing more than a useless party trick. I'm talking about the touchless gestures. I think they even had a commercial where the big selling point was some guy eating ribs and not getting his iPhone screen dirty. And yeah, I get it. You know, hand-waving gesture controls are cool. They're kind of the stuff of sci-fi. It looks really neat, but on a phone with a touchscreen, I said at the time Samsung was doing it, and I'll say the same thing about Apple. I just don't get it. I'm not entirely convinced I see the benefit. Now, I guess you know, Apple's a pretty innovative company, and they really won't add features to a device unless they have a really good use case for people being able to do more with their phone because of the additive technology. They don't just do it as party tricks. So I have faith there. And I also guess that it could be playing into some of Apple's augmented reality or virtual reality efforts, especially if some of the sort of patents and things we've seen around Apple's technology in the AR field particularly come to be, because they have a few designs that show kind of using the iPhone mounted in some sort of headset as your augmented reality glasses. And if your phone is stuck to your face, you're going to need some other way to kind of control it. So you would think, okay, well, maybe then gesture controls make a little bit of sense. But the Bloomberg piece for at least this rumor say that the gestures would be happening very close to the screen. So it's almost like you kind of hover your finger over the screen and you almost have an extra kind of click or an extra gesture. So it may be additive in that way, similar to the way that Force Touch is additive to the gesture language of your iOS device. So I guess you would have a, you know, don't quite push in all the way, a touch, and then a push in hard, and you'd kind of have three levels of detail there. And I guess maybe they could do some interesting things there. So we'll have to see. Another cool thing about this technology is the piece does claim that Apple would build and integrate the sensors for this directly into the display itself. So there wouldn't be other sensors or other things on the phone that you would have to drive, I guess, with additional battery power. I guess it would take a little bit of energy, but who really knows? It's you know, gesture control on a touchscreen device, again, I'm not quite sold on it, but I think if anybody can pull it off maybe and give me a use case for it, it might be Apple. The other part of this rumor, of course, is that the iPhone would be curved, almost like a banana, kind of curved inward. And that kind of immediately puts me off too, because I think about putting my phone down on a table and just having it rock there like some sort of seesaw or something like that. It just doesn't feel useful to me. Now, I did read one article that pointed out that, you know, a curved screen phone, especially when it comes to the front glass, is a little bit more durable, because if you drop it, it's not likely to land flat and then have a rock or something shoot up into the screen and crack it, although you would still be susceptible, I would imagine, on the edges. But again, when I started thinking about that curved shape, I thought back to your phone as a set of augmented reality glasses. And if you think about glasses, especially like high-end sunglasses or something like that, you're going to want to have your peripheral view maybe covered up a little bit. So maybe it makes a little more sense to kind of have a curved screen or curved display in front of your eyes. So maybe that's what's going on there. You know, the piece does say that these projects are in early R&D stages. Apple is always playing around with all sorts of things. And who knows if these features or devices will ever actually even see the light of day. But supposedly something Apple is looking into for future generations of the iPhone. Another rumor that's been thrown out there for a while is that Apple is maybe working on a foldable display, an iPhone that would actually fold in half across the glass. And there's a number of companies that are looking into this. Supposedly Samsung and maybe some of Apple's other competitors are going to have these in the marketplace as soon as next year. I've seen some of this technology at, in person a few years back, where they didn't bend very much. But I guess this has been being shown off at CES for a few years now. I don't think we're quite to the point where you can fold the display directly in half without some sort of hinge. So I'm very curious to see what these first generation products look like. Apple usually doesn't jump in on the first generation because a lot of times, really, let's be honest, it's not quite ready for prime time. So I think they're going to wait for that technology to mature, but that is another screen technology that's being rumored. Something we're hearing about with new iPhones that may show up a little bit more immediately, maybe not next year, but maybe the year after it, is a triple lens camera. We're already seeing this in some other phones that have started to come out this year, and the idea is that you can have different focal lengths, you can compensate for things like low light levels, and you can have different f-stops and those sorts of things on these various lenses. And supposedly Apple's looking into adding an additional lens to the front-facing camera on a future iPhone. They say it's going to be a 12-megapixel sensor still. This news is coming out of Taiwan's Economic Daily News. They say it will be a 6P lens and offer a 5X zoom. Now, they don't mention that being an optical zoom, but I would assume so, considering that the iPhone X, I believe, has a 2X optical zoom. So it makes sense for that to be optical and not digital. We already have 10X digital zooms, so that really wouldn't be anything new. And, you know, anytime Apple can improve the phone and the camera, or the camera capabilities in the phone, rather, I think that's a great thing. And it's a natural progression. So I fully expect, if, you know, triple lens cameras start to take off in iPhone, in phones in general, that Apple will adopt the technology for a future iPhone. And then finally, even more immediately, as a matter of fact, starting tomorrow as I record this podcast, there is a new version of the iPhone 8 and iPhone 8 Plus. Not anything new in terms of the specs, but a brand new color. Apple released their product red versions. We were expecting those to come out. Unfortunately, there is not a product red iPhone 10, but there is a product red iPhone 10 leather case. So you can get a leather case for your iPhone 10, or if you've been in the market for a new iPhone 8 or 8 Plus, that new red color looks really, really gorgeous on the screenshots, and it has a nice red metallic band around the edge too. It looks really nice. You'll be able to order one from Apple's online store, pre-order one on Tuesday the 10th of April, and they will be shipping and supposedly available in Apple retail stores this Friday the 13th of April. And again, I was really surprised that there was not a red version of the iPhone X. We had been kind of hearing rumors about that, and I would have thought Apple would have wanted to do that to kind of stimulate sales, and they didn't. So I don't know. That's maybe a sign. I just can't figure out if it's a sign for the positive direction of the iPhone X, like they're selling enough that they don't need kind of a boost in sales, or is it more we don't want to put out a red version because the iPhone X isn't selling that well, which is what all the rumors have been saying, that, you know, Apple has not had good sales on the iPhone X, and so maybe they didn't want to add more options to the mix to potentially break up, you know, how people were buying. I don't really know. You know, Tim Cook says the iPhone X has been selling great and Apple's been happy with it, and I'm more inclined to believe their numbers. So I'm going to take it as a sign that maybe the iPhone X is selling just fine without having to put out a new color or a new edition. But those are out and available this week. So if you're looking for that, check it out. You can check out images and things like that too on Apple's online site, which has been updated. All right. Lastly, in the news for this week, we have information about the Mac Pro, the update to the 2013 Trash Can Mac. You may remember about a year ago, Apple invited a very small select group of reporters out. They came to talk to them specifically about their plans for updating the, at that time, already four-year-old Mac Pro. And they said, yep, we're working on an entirely new modular system. We understand why people were not, you know, why a number of pros were not happy with the last Mac Pro design. We're even going to have an Apple display to go with it. At the time, Phil Schiller said, now you won't see any of the products this year. So that was in 2017. We're in the process of that. And they didn't necessarily give a date, but I think a lot of us, myself included, sort of assumed in about a year, 18 months, we would see that Mac Pro. Of course, we did get the iMac Pro, which is an amazing Pro system, but probably not the Pro system that a lot of high-end professionals were really looking for. So a lot that left a lot of people wondering, okay, when's the Mac Pro coming? When are we going to see this awesome new modular design? When can we get it? We know you're working on it. Well, we got a little more info this week and a potential sort of birth date range of when that new Mac Pro might be coming. And it's not anytime soon, folks. Sometime in 2019. Yes, a full 6 years after the release of the last Mac Pro. Apparently, that's how long it takes to build a machine. The information came out in an interview given to TechCrunch. Apple's Vice President of Hardware Engineering, Tom Boger, he said the Mac Pro is a 2019 product. this is not something for this year. So that's pretty definitive. We're not going to see it in 2018. And I'm sorry, but in my opinion, that totally sucks. I am not happy about this announcement whatsoever. By the time we see that replacement, 6 years will have gone by, as I already said. And I think many of Apple's pro customers, the few diehards who are left and have been waiting and waiting, will have moved on. And I don't think anyone can blame them. You know, like, I can't believe it's taking that long. A company with almost $300 billion in the bank, cash on hand, they can't design a pro desktop tower in 6 years. It takes them that long. Now, why is it taking that long? A lot of you probably want to know. I know I wanted to know. In the piece, Apple says it's taking their time to understand pro workflows. And they even said they have a whole special team that is just working on figuring out what creative pros need, not only in terms of the hardware, but also in terms of software, and not just the software, but also the integration and how that works into their workflows. They have this team working with high-end creative pro shops and studios, those companies that focus on visual effects and video editing and 3D animation and music production. They're working with those folks and trying to figure out where the bottlenecks are, minimize those things. The idea being that if you're working at that high level, any time that slows you down, any interruptions, any length of time it takes to do rendering, or any time you have to stop, that's lost productivity, and that's something you just can't afford. So they're trying to really optimize things there. And believe me, I get it. I get making sure that this thing gets built, that it's designed right, that it is the right machine for that market is super, super important. And I applaud Apple's efforts here. And I definitely appreciate that if it's not ready to go, if they can't do something, that they don't release it. Fine. And the fact that they're telling us now, that's a good thing too. They put out one of the reasons, and I think this is legitimate. You have some pros who are on the fence. They're in need of a new machine because, frankly, let's say they bought one in 2013. It's now 5 years into it, right? You are thinking, I need an upgrade. I need something. Do I go to a PC? Do I wait for what Apple's going to do with the Mac Pro, or do I buy an iMac Pro now? Well, at least you know if you need a pro machine today and it needs to have an Apple logo on it, your only option is an iMac Pro. You're going to have to go that route because it's going to be another year. And again, they didn't say when in 2019 we would see a Mac Pro, so it could be December. You know, we could be looking at another 18 months or more, longer, before we actually see this machine in the market. And I just think, I just feel for the pros out there. It just makes me so frustrated. You know, I think they really maybe should have thrown together, if they knew it was going to take this long, in my opinion, they should have thrown together some sort of stopgap. I think I told a few people, and I was only half joking when I said this, they could have gone back to the cheese grater Mac Pro, upgraded all the internals with brand new stuff, the latest generation of, you know, dual GPUs, massive Intel processors in there, the best, you know, that Intel has to offer to date, throw in room for tons of RAM. You've got all the slots in there for graphics cards, add USB 3 and Thunderbolt support across the board, make it a super fast bus. And I think you'd have a lot of pros who would be very, very happy to buy that machine. But Apple didn't offer that up. They've just left them in this wasteland with nothing to buy. And I think a lot of them have jumped ship and just went and bought PCs. And I think once you have them moved into that market, once they're in that space and they're already working there, you're going to have a lot more trouble winning those people back. You're going to have to work a lot harder to win the hearts and minds of that customer base back. And this was a loyal customer base, but they've been burned so many times by Apple over the years for their loyalty that it's going to just be a hard sell. So this thing, I mean, it doesn't just have to be a home run. It has to be a triple, quadruple, grand slam, I think, to win these customers back. And I'm really hoping that Apple can pull it off. And again, if they need this much more time to get it done, more power to them. But in the short term, just incredibly frustrating news this week, I think, at least when it comes to Pro Desktops and the Mac. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. And I'd love to get your opinions on this. I guess real quick before we move on. Of course, as always here on the MacCast, this is a community podcast. I want to know your thoughts and opinions. I want you to share those with me, and we'll separate those out and share them with the community as well. I especially want to hear from you folks who maybe have a Mac Pro, a 2013 Mac Pro. Are you holding on to it? Have you already moved on to something else? Are you, you know, done with Apple when it comes to the Pro environment? Apple did release some nice new updates to Final Cut 10 this week as well. So, you know, Apple's doing some things here and there, but I think they need to do a lot more. All right, moving on. Let's talk a little bit about the HomePod really quickly. I don't want to get into it too much, but we did have the release of iOS 11.3. The iOS 11.3 update came out, and there are a few people out online reporting that they think that Apple tweaked the sound profile of the HomePod a little bit to maybe address what I feel were some complaints by this community, but some people are not happy about the changes either. Some people are saying that after running the update, they think that they're getting a little less bass profile in their music, and that the Apple put a little more emphasis on the mid-range. And we already know that Apple is controlling the sound profile inside the HomePod. You don't have any EQ controls. You can't really tweak things yourself. And a lot of people would like that ability. They're hoping that Apple adds that at some point in the future, but we don't have that at this point. And early on, a lot of the reviewers said, whoa, it's got a lot of bass. You know, they drew a lot of parallels to Beats headphones, which over the years have been knocked by many for their heavy bass profile. And I will even admit that for me, it is a little bit heavier on the bass than I would prefer for some of my tracks, but nothing really bad. And again, because the HomePod is so good at its overall balance, it's a strong bass profile, but not one that overpowers the rest of the music. But if they can bump up the mid-tone, I think that's great. Personally, after having run the update, I can't really tell much of a difference. So if it did change, I'm not enough of an audiophile to really hear it. But what about you? Have you heard a change? This is why I'm bringing this up mainly, is to find out, is did you hear a change after the 11.3 update? And what do you think about it? So shoot me some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. It's been a little while since we talked about it, but I think I mentioned a while back that, I have an iPad Pro, a 12.9-inch, the first-generation version, and I absolutely love it. I also have an Apple Pencil and a Smart Keyboard, but I've had more recently continued problems with my Smart Keyboard where I'll have it docked, the keyboard will be up, and suddenly it'll just drop the connection or it won't connect at all, and I have to kind of fiddle with the screen. I have to undock it, reconnect it to kind of get it to reattach and to be able to use the keyboard. And it's really, really annoying. And I was curious if it was a hardware problem or a software problem, because I did take my keyboard to Apple. They said it was a known issue when I was at the store. They replaced my Smart Keyboard for me, but that didn't really fix the problem. And when I threw it out to the community, a number of you emailed or wrote back and said, yep, I'm having exactly the same problem. And so we kind of deduced and left it at the fact that it's likely a software problem. And I have to say, my issues continue to go on, but after the 11.3 update, I'm having fewer problems, but that may just be luck. I don't really know, because it still seems like there are some issues there. And I'm still getting reports from a number of people that are going into Apple retail stores with their Smart Keyboards and being told by geniuses and folks at the Genius Bar that it is a known issue. And in many of the cases, just like I experienced, some of you are getting replacement keyboards. And I'm bringing this up this week because I've had listeners who've had multiple keyboard replacements done by Apple for this reason, but almost everybody has always come back and said, nope, I'm still having the issue. And I got an email like that this week too. Someone said, hey, I went in, I talked to the geniuses of the Genius Bar. They said, yep, we know what the problem is. Let us give you a new Smart Keyboard. And that leads me to believe that Apple thinks there's some sort of hardware problem and not software problem, because why would they keep replacing keyboards? But the fact that those of you in the community who've said, I've had my keyboard replaced, myself included, who are coming back and say, nope, it doesn't fix the issue, Now I'm confused once again. Why are we having these flaky smart keyboards? Is it software? Is it something in iOS that can be addressed with a software firmware update? Or is it a massive design flaw in the smart cover design? And I'm starting to lean toward the latter, but then wondering if Apple's giving out replacement keyboards, why they haven't addressed the underlying hardware design issue, if that's what it is. So I'm curious to get your take on this. Again, we've got a nice little data set pool here in the MacCast community. So has anyone actually solved this problem or had it solved for them, either by a new piece of hardware or by a software update? I haven't had luck in either direction, and I'm curious what your experiences have been. All right. I got an email this week from Steven, and he kind of brings up, we've been talking a lot on the MacCast about sort of Apple support, and in the past there's been sort of questions about Apple's commitment to the quality of software and software updates and testing and things like that. We've had a few generations and rounds with both on macOS and iOS where some of the updates have brought kind of annoying bugs and things like that. I don't think anything major, well, we can point to some major ones too, I guess. So Apple has had this question, called into question their commitment to software Q&A, I think, before releasing an update. And Steven emailed me this week because the macOS 10.13.4 update, the latest update for macOS 10 High Sierra, came out, and a number of kind of display bugs have cropped up that seem pretty serious, especially if you're impacted by them. Specifically, apps that let you use your iPad screen as a second display. So things like Duet, which is a great app where you can turn your iPad, I've used it with my iPad Pro, into a display. There's a number of apps like that. Those are reportedly breaking, causing the Mac to crash or just display blank screens. And then also USB monitors that use the display link technology have stopped working. And both the developers of apps like Duet and some of the other iPad screen sharing apps have noted the problem and are aware of it. And also the folks over at DisplayLink, they've kind of rushed out, I think, a beta update of their drivers that addresses part of the issue. So you can now use your DisplayLink display as a mirrored display, but you can't use it in extended desktop mode. So that's broken. Steven also mentioned some pretty significant bugs with some of the Jamf products, which is mobile device management software, some pretty big bugs there. And so the question he had was, you know, is Apple continuing to kind of rush updates out without fixing bugs that have been reported by developers? Like, these seem like some pretty serious bugs. It seems unlikely that, you know, they just suddenly showed up in the gold master version of macOS 10.13.4. You know, like, it doesn't feel like the kind of thing that would have just cropped up at the last minute, that it should have gone through testing and people should have noticed this. So is Apple just ignoring that and pushing these updates out anyway? Or is it, you know, on the developer side, the developers have access to these, they know about the bugs, and they are not taking the steps to either report the issues back to Apple or to fix the issues before they're going out? And that was the question Steven posed to me. Steven, you know, unfortunately, I don't know. I really don't have the answer. And I think only the teams inside Apple could really answer this question. I agree that it seems very odd that these bugs would suddenly just crop up out of nowhere, but that's not entirely out of the realm of possibility. I mean, stranger things have happened. Bugs can sometimes show up months later that no one noticed. This one seems like somebody would have noticed it, but I don't know. And I really think kind of both scenarios can occur. I think also sometimes developers just run out of time. They find a bug, they know what it is, they're trying to patch it and fix it quickly, but, you know, Apple's not going to just necessarily wait for them before they do a big major release, especially if it's not the kind of bug that's going to impact all of the users out there. If it's a small subset, Apple kind of has to weigh what they're doing and decide, yeah, we got to get this thing pushed out and we'll deal with that bug as we go along. I think and I feel often that the bigger bugs are quote unquote bigger rather when they impact you, obviously, you know. So like, this feels like a huge bug for people who use DisplayLink or people who use an iPad as a second monitor or something like that. But for the rest of everybody, it's really probably not impacting them. So Apple may have made that into their, you know, go into that, their into their decision on when to release or when to wait. And I just really don't know because I'm not inside Apple. I'm not privy to information from those teams. And, you know, this one, again, it's a big deal if you no longer have your second display or your machine is crashing. You know, it's a pretty big deal to you. And rolling back is not necessarily easy or convenient. Luckily, you can still do it on macOS, unlike iOS. And I think this problem is on the macOS side. But it seems unlikely that, you know, the issue just sort of popped up when Apple pushed out 10.13.4. So really anything is possible. Also, the reality, unfortunately, is that bugs will always exist and they'll always happen. And the best we can do is report them. We do know that in this case, the software makers and Display Link and all those folks are working with Apple. They're on top of it. So hopefully we'll get some fixes pushed out relatively quickly. There we go. But the question becomes, you know, do we have a dilemma here? Because we do have this concept of when, especially a point release update comes out, that we should apply it as quickly as possible because of security reasons, right? Very often these have critical security patches. So you want to update. But that mixes with the fact that maybe you don't want to be the very first to update. You might want to wait a little while. And I'm more and more starting to fall in the camp of, hey, don't update day one unless it's just a critical security patch. Those you probably want to grab right away. But if it's simply a software update that maybe has some security patches in it, I think there's no harm in maybe waiting a couple days, maybe waiting a week, letting some of the early adopters go in and find little weird bugs and problems like this, and then upgrade. You know, wait a couple days, do a little searching online, see if there isn't some kind of weird bugs or issues that come out with a release, and then make the decision to upgrade or update. And, you know, I almost, again, hate to give that advice because we do want to make sure people are upgrading, but I think you can give yourself a little bit of a reasonable window and maybe not upgrade day one. And maybe that's the way to go about it. I mean, honestly, I'm still running macOS 10.12 Sierra, and that's mainly because I just haven't had time to upgrade. I didn't want to upgrade day one, especially my production machine, because I didn't want to run into any small weird quirks. But, you know, now I've been wanting to upgrade for a while. I just haven't had found the time to do it. So I guess I benefit in this case because I wasn't impacted by this recent little rash of bugs, but I don't think I really would have been anyway. I do use Duet Display, but not all that frequently. But I don't know. I'd be curious to know what the community thinks. You know, do you think this is a problem that we're running into this sort of upgrade dilemma more and more, that Apple is maybe not being as careful? They did recently say they are going to make some changes to their QA team. So maybe those really haven't been implemented quite yet with this update, and we may see things improve over time. But overall, you know, I don't think these are major big problems, and I don't think they're necessarily as frustrating as they can be when you experience them. I don't think they're anything out of the ordinary or any more extreme than they ever have been with prior releases. Phil emailed me this week, and unfortunately, Phil is having a wake from sleep issue on his Mac. And I think we've all been there, right? Some sort of wake from sleep issue. I occasionally have a problem where hard drives will disconnect when they're not supposed to. And I see that nasty error message, your drive has unexpectedly disconnected and that sort of thing. But in this case, Phil, unfortunately, is experiencing a total lockup on wake from sleep. And he's been trying to troubleshoot it the best he can. He's gone in and got some advice from Apple support. And unfortunately, they gave him the advice that most of us don't want to hear, which is you need to back up, completely erase your drive, and restore. And not only that, but restore and set the machine up as new. Do not restore from backup, because we think maybe you have some corruption in there, and so you're going to have to hand copy over all your files and information, basically do a full clean install of the operating system. And Phil was emailing me to ask, you know, what do I do? How do I make sure that I don't lose all of my data when doing a clean install? And was asking me to point him in the direction. And we've covered this in the MacCast in the past. If you just go search for clean install. I think it's been a few years, but the general procedures remain the same. And I'll get into some of the tips, not in any real detail, but into some of the tips a little bit later for you here, Phil, in this segment. But, you know, I did want to talk about this idea of having to do a complete erase and clean install and how disruptive that really is when you have to do it. And unfortunately, we do have to do it from time to time. I do it every few years or so. I'm actually overdue to do it, which is another reason why I haven't upgraded to High Sierra yet, because I am planning on doing a complete clean install. And the clean install takes a long time. You know, it's a good weekend project for me, because you've got to kind of pull things back one by one and be very methodical. But it's much easier to do a sort of install and restore from backup, either a clone backup or a Time Machine backup. And I think that's always a place where you can start. So if you haven't done that yet, you might consider that. But even before doing that, even before going that extreme, I thought I'd kind of give you some tips and tricks and some steps that you might want to try before going with what we call the nuclear option, right? Nuke and pave. Of course, the very first thing to be absolutely sure of is that you have backups and that you have good backups, at least two full backups before you do an erase and install. And that's because the minute, if you only have one backup, the minute that you erase your main hard drive, if you have your main hard drive and the one backup, you now no longer have a backup, right? So if something, God forbid, at that time was to go horribly wrong in the middle of that erase and install, and you go to your backup and you find your backup's corrupted, well, you're sunk. You're going to lose data at that point. And Phil, you emailed me specifically to say, how do I avoid losing my data? So very first thing, make sure you have at least two full backups. And I would say make sure one is a clone. I usually do one Time Machine backup and one clone backup using SuperDuper or Carbon Copy Cloner. And then I also have a third online backup. I would recommend that you have some sort of offsite. If you can pull a third backup, that's really great. If you can't do a third full backup, I would advise backup at least in a third form, that data that you would be really, really upset if you lost. And typically for most people I know, that's things like emails, maybe current project files for work that you're currently working on, photo libraries, media files. If you spent a lot of time, you know, ripping your entire DVD or Blu-ray collection, and you don't want to have to re-rip that stuff all over again because that's very time consuming, you might want to have an extra copy or backup of that. So do all of that, and also confirm and make sure that you can recover from your backup. So go into the backup, read some files directly off of it, see if you can pull some back, copying them back to your hard drive. Just make sure all of that stuff is working. All right. So then once you're confirmed and you know you have your backups, and I know because many of you are MacCast listeners that you already have these, so you don't have to worry about that step, right? You're good to go. After you do that, before you go with the nuclear option, I would say do some troubleshooting. Look through the console log for clues, especially if you're having hard crashes like you've been experiencing. So go into Applications Utilities, open up the console, and I know it can be a little bit daunting to look through log files, but you're going to want to look at the main overall log file, which is right there. You're also going to want to look at the system log file. Mainly the system log is probably where you're going to be looking for these things. And just search in there for the date and time when you notice the crash happen. So if you're attempting to wake from sleep and it's 8:45 in the morning, look around 8:45 that morning in the crash logs, and there's going to be a lot of gibberish in there. I'll tell you right up front, there's going to be a lot of things you don't understand. I look in mine and there's a lot of things I don't understand. But you might see something that references waking from sleep, and when you see that, you can kind of look around and you can maybe see what processes or things are running at that time. And typically what you're looking for, in most cases, I would say, is some sort of application or reference to an application that might be running in the background, that might be trying to do things when you're waking from sleep or just as your Mac is asleep. And it might be something that you installed years ago and you totally forgot about because you're doing over-the-top install. So it could be a mouse driver. It could be some sort of old screensaver. It could be some sort of backup application or archiving application, any of those sorts of things, and see if it's not registering a crash or something like that. And especially if it ends up being something that you don't use anymore and you just forgot was on your computer, you could simply try uninstalling it or removing it, taking it out of there and that may resolve your problem. So look through the console log, see if you can find any clues. Another thing to do would be go and look at any login items, look at menu bar items that you might have installed, anything that might be running in the background. So for login or startup items, go into System Preferences, into your Users and Groups, and look at the startup items and see if there isn't anything in there that you might want to clean out, or your menu bar items, all those sorts of things. Anything that you can possibly remove or eliminate would be a good thing. Another thing you can do for testing crashes, of course, is boot up your Mac holding down the shift key, boot it into safe mode, which means it will only boot up and install with the system extensions and system add-ons and background processes and stuff like that. Run it like that for a little bit, let it go to sleep, come back, wake it up, and see if you still have the wake from sleep issue. If you don't, if it wakes up normally, then you know it's likely some sort of third-party thing that you installed, and you've at least narrowed your search parameters for what you're looking for. Another way you can kind of test this too is create a temporary new user account. So go into System Preferences, into Users and Groups, and create just a new user account. Log out of your main user account and log into this new test one, and again, try to replicate the issue. If you can't replicate the issue, then you know you probably have a problem inside your users folder and not just the system level stuff. And in that case, that may be an indication that, yeah, you do need to do some sort of nuke and pave. But even before you do that, if you've narrowed it down to, okay, it's something in my user account, what you might want to do is, again, look for these background processes, look in a couple of the common, what I would call, not trouble areas, but areas where things may have been installed by an application into your user account. And I'm talking about the user library folder in most cases, in some specific locations that I'm going to tell you about. Look in there and see if you can't find maybe the source of the problem. So look in your home folder, in the library folder, inside the preferences. Maybe look at things like the preference panes. You probably want to look in the library application support folder. And I'm only mentioning that folder because it may have applications in there that, again, are old applications that maybe you installed a long time ago. And typically, you're going to want to look for things that operate at a low level. So remote control software, any drivers for mice or keyboards or third-party accessories, printer stuff, just anything weird or out of the ordinary that just may not be compatible, say, with the latest version of the operating system. You could have old stuff in there that you didn't think was running anymore, you didn't think you were using it anymore, but there's these remnants of stuff that could be causing your problems. Also look at the system preferences and look for any third-party system preferences that might be installed. They're typically the ones in the bottom row of your system preference pane. So I have, you know, one for my Backblaze backup, which I know is supposed to be there, and there's a Fuse one, and I have my MySQL, but you might find some third-party apps that have installed things there. And again, those things could be running in the background or running when you're not realizing it and causing your problem. So check for all that stuff. And then if you do find things, uninstall any of those old applications. And if you can find an uninstaller program for it, that's the best way to go. So a lot of times if you re-download the installer, it'll have an uninstall option, or just look online for how to uninstall it and uninstall all the bits and parts and pieces of it. If you can't find something like that, you can use a tool like Clean My Mac 3, which I absolutely love. It has an uninstaller and it will go through and it'll look for all those pieces that are in the library preference folder and the preference panes folder and the application support folder, and it will get all those little bits and pieces that are strewn around your operating system and clean those out. And so that can be particularly helpful. And then the last thing you should probably do before you do a full nuke and pave, so if none of that other stuff works, go ahead and download the latest combo update of the current version of your operating system. And you can get that from Apple's support website. If you go to support.apple.com/downloads, you can find what's called the combo updater for your version of macOS and just run that right over the top. And what that's going to do is, if you have any broken bits or pieces of the operating system, it's going to go in and fix those up. If for some reason, typically shouldn't happen, but if for some reason some sort of application or something messed with something, it should go through and actually clean up and fix that, and that could potentially fix your problem. So if that does it, again, you're not stuck doing a full reinstall of the operating system. And then finally, if you absolutely must do a nuke and pave, just be ready for a long, arduous process. Make sure that you have backups of all your files. And what you're going to have to do is erase your hard drive, install the operating system, set up a new user account. I would use the same username that you were using before. Don't change any of that stuff. And then you're going to go through the long process of reinstalling all of your apps. So make sure that you have copies of all your license keys handy that you need. Of course, stuff from the Mac App Store is going to be a little bit easier because you can just open up the Mac App Store app and reinstall all of that stuff. And then you're going to have to one by one by hand copy back all of your user folder information. So your documents folder, your music folder, your pictures folder. Don't forget to go in to your library folder into the mail folder and bring back all of your mail library and database. And you're probably going to have to go in and selectively restore those application support files from the library, the preference files from the library, if you had certain window settings and things like that, system preference panes, menu items, all that stuff you're going to have to reinstall by hand. You're going to have to do redo configurations, reinstall passwords. Again, it is a giant pain in the rear. Luckily for like iCloud stuff, documents, and some of that stuff, you can sync all of that stuff back, but it is not a fun process and something that I typically like to avoid. So I understand you not wanting to do it. I certainly understand you not wanting to lose anything. So hopefully some of this information helps you out. Again, go back and search the old episodes of the MacCast if you want full step-by-step instructions on how to do a clean install, or, you know, just do a Google search online. There's a number of great websites that have those steps. I think Mac Observer has some of those tips and tricks and things like that. It shouldn't be too hard to find that information. And good luck to you, Phil. I hope some of this stuff helps and that you don't have to go the full nuke and pave option. But even if you do, I hope this makes it a little bit easier. A question I get asked about a lot on the MacCast, and we probably need to cover a little bit more in depth, but not in this episode, is remote access, being able to be out and about and remotely get back to your Mac and control it. And Apple has had a technology for a really long time called Back to My Mac, and it's one option that you can use for gaining remote access to your Mac. But as Brett is about to tell us, it doesn't necessarily always go that smoothly.
Hey, Adam, this is Brett from Long Beach. I love the show, and this is the first time I've called to leave you a message because I've had a Mac ever since they came out, and I love the Mac, but there's a problem I've had the last couple of years that I can't fix, and that is with Back to My Mac. So the Back to My Mac service is activated on three different computers at three different locations, and I have tried replacing routers and changing settings, and I have followed all of Apple's instructions online. I can get Back to My Mac to work sometimes, kind of sporadically, but not consistently. When it works, I can see the remote Macs, but more often than not, I can't see the remote Macs, even though the service is turned on all three locations. So my question for you is, if anyone else is having this trouble, I imagine they are, because there's lots of documentation on it online, and I'm curious why this problem has been going on for so long, and if there is a known fix for it, because I can't find it, if there is. And I contrast this to Parallels Access. The Parallels Access service works every time, and so I wonder why Apple can't have a version of that kind of service that works every time, like Parallels Access does. Thank you. Bye.
Hey, Brett. Thanks. So your question basically is, why can't Apple make nice things in iCloud, I think? And it's a question a lot of us have very often when it comes to iCloud stuff. I think they finally got their syncing stuff down. That seems to work pretty well. And Documents in the Cloud works pretty well for me. And so does iCloud Photo Library, along with Apple Music. But yeah, I have to admit, Back to My Mac It's great in concept. It's great in theory. It's awesome when it works. And this is probably what you're responding to as much as I respond to that when it works, it's so awesome. So you want it to work all the time, but unfortunately it hardly ever works. And you never really know why. You never really know why it works sometimes and doesn't work other times. And as you alluded to in your comments there, you're not alone. There are a lot of us that have the same sorts of issues. Now, I know you've gone through Apple support documents, so you've probably done a number of the things that I'm going to recommend to you, but I'm bringing them up just in case there's other people out there who want to give these things a try who've run into issues with Back to My Mac. And I think the issues and the reason as to why these things happen to Back to My Mac versus other services is I think it's just slightly more complex with how Apple handles security and the protocols and things being proprietary. We'll talk about that here in a second. But I want to go through a couple of the little things that people can try if they're having trouble getting Back to My Mac working, to maybe get it up and running again, or at least working occasionally. And I know a big one of the issues is letting your Mac go to sleep. So you do need to kind of go in if you're going to use Back to My Mac and change the energy saver settings, unfortunately, on your machines. And you really are best off if you can set them to really not ever go to sleep. You can do display sleep, but you don't want the machine really going to sleep. And you can play around and try the wake on network activity option. But I've personally found that very often that never seems to work. So I end up always just having to go in and move that little slider to say never go to sleep and then let the display go to sleep at a normal time, you know, like 10 minutes or something like that. But keep the machine running. Also, the brand of router you're using and how that router is configured specifically with respect to NAT addresses, network address translation, and supporting PNP, and all those sorts of things need to be turned on. And you're very often going to have better luck if you're running an airport router, because you can turn on the Back to My Mac settings for your airport, and that's going to make things a little bit easier to control and set up. So, you know, sticking Apple all the way, which is getting harder and harder considering that Apple doesn't make airport routers anymore. So you kind of really don't want to invest in an airport router just to run Back to My Mac. And I would totally understand that. Another thing you can do is just make sure that all the ports that are needed, and there are a ton of them, so just search online for Back to My Mac port numbers and you'll find the Tech Info article. But make sure all the port numbers are opened on your routers and your firewalls, and there really is a ton of them. And so getting to the slightly more complex and reasons why I think Back to My Mac in particular has more troubles than maybe some other remote software solutions, remote access software solutions, is just the ports that Apple uses. They're generally proprietary to Apple. And I think that a lot of networks that you're maybe on, especially when you're remote, so think you're trying to use, you know, Wi-Fi hotspots at Starbucks or your hotel Wi-Fi or wherever you might be, I think a lot of those ports just end up being blocked and the communication just can't happen. And why they would be open for other services like Parallels Access or VNC or any of these other solutions, Microsoft Remote Desktop, is I think especially in the IT industry, a lot of those ports are kind of more standardized. It's just a fact of the matter that more systems support Windows technologies, and like RNC or whatever Windows calls their remote desktop technology, RDC, remote desktop computer. I think those are more standardized. You know, VNC has been around for a long time and they kind of run on standard ports and the communications are known to those kinds of networks. So I think you're sometimes encountering that sort of issue, but I'm not certain of that. I maybe somebody who works in the IT world, especially with Macs, who's out in our community, can explain this a little bit better than I can. But the reality is that yes, for most of us, Back to My Mac is kind of a hit and miss technology. It doesn't really work all that well, and so you end up abandoning it. And like you said, if Parallels Access works for you really, really well, I went and looked at that, because that's a service I haven't tried. I have Parallels for running Windows on my machine, you know, doing virtual machine, but I've never looked at the remote access software. If that works well for you, it's $19 a year for a single computer, I think, with or you can connect to 5 computers, but for like a personal connection, $20 a year and it works. Just forget about Back to My Mac, buy that and be done with it at the end of the day. And I know there's other remote access solutions out there. People bring them up very often. You can use and set up VNC on your Mac if you want to open the ports. And I've had really good luck using that. There's great VNC clients for iOS devices, so I'm able to control from my iPad. Now, you do have to know a little bit more about how you set up your security and your firewalls and things on your router, so I would advise you to be careful there. If you're running a VNC server on your home network, you may even want to set up things like doing a VPN to secure that even a little bit more. And, you know, especially if you're going to be using open Wi-Fi hotspots or hotel Wi-Fi to access that stuff. But you can set that up, and that typically works pretty well. Again, the biggest thing you're going to have to deal with there is DNS changes on your home modem or, ISP. And you can handle that with stuff like Dyn DNS or some other technologies. So, but again, at $20 a year, I wouldn't even waste your time with VNC. If Parallels works, I think it has pretty good security built into it. Just go with that and pay that money and don't worry about Back to My Mac too much. But maybe someone in our community does know how to get Back to My Mac working. I just couldn't find any information on it. Just like you, you search around online and you hear a lot of people who are having problems and not a lot of solutions. So sorry, I can't help you out on that end, but hopefully just opening up the conversation maybe yields a few more answers, and we'll have to just see. And if I hear from somebody, we'll do some follow-up on a future episode of the MacCast. All right, I want to bring up something finally today that I think confuses a lot of folks, because unfortunately, I get a lot of frustrated emails from listeners about this topic, and that happened this week, which is why I'm kind of bringing this up. Most of the time, it's over concerns about Time Machine and losing the backup history of Time Machine for one reason or another. So you've been using Time Machine like you should. It's great. It's running along. Suddenly you get a pop-up alert message that says something has gone wrong and you need to erase and start Time Machine over. And that's when the panic sets in, and that's usually when someone emails Adam and says, oh my God, I'm going to lose all my Time Machine history. What am I going to do? I'm not going to have my access to all of the files that I deleted 6 months ago. And my answer always is, don't worry, because that's not what Time Machine is for. It's not an archive necessarily for going back and getting everything all the way back to the beginning of time. Yes, that is a feature of Time Machine, but it's not its main purpose. Its main purpose is really as a backup system to back up your computer on a regularly scheduled basis so that you can recover your computer in the case of a hard drive failure to the state it was in at that moment in time. It does have this Time Machine element, which Apple sells. It's even in the name, and I get it, but that's never a guaranteed history. You're never guaranteed to have those files. You don't know when Time Machine is necessarily going to go through and delete those, right? It depends on the storage size of your drive. I also hear similar complaints or similar concerns about online backup systems, because some online backup services don't keep deleted file archives forever. Now, CrashPlan was one of the few companies, and unfortunately they've gotten out of the home backup business, that held on to any deleted files for as long as you wanted. You could go in and set a setting, but the default was never. So if you deleted something on CrashPlan 3 years ago and you still have an active CrashPlan account, you could go back and recover that file. And a lot of people like that. That is data retention, is what they call it. And they had infinite data retention for your files, which was great, but maybe that's one of the reasons why they got out of the home business. Like, storing those files for forever after you've deleted them, you've already told them, hey, I don't want this file anymore, I'm taking it off my hard drive. You know, that's a lot of storage space, and there's costs associated with that. So they couldn't make that work. Other services like Backblaze, which is something that I've moved to, I've recommended, they've been a sponsor here on the MacCast, they have a 30-day retention policy. So if you delete a file, it'll sit on their servers for 30 days. After 30 days, they assume you don't need it anymore and they expunge it. So you can't go back and get it. So that's something good to know about when you're evaluating backup services. So take a look at that. If that's important to you, that they have your deleted files for forever, make sure you find a service that's going to do that. And Crash Plan for Business, I think, is one of your few options. Maybe there's some others out there that people know about and can let us know about. But the point is, as you may or may not know, you know, Time Machine, it retains deleted files until it needs more space. And then when it needs that more space, it starts removing your oldest deleted files to make room for new ones. And it's why I recommend, if you're looking at a Time Machine drive, that you get a drive that's at least 2 times the total size of all the drives that you want to back up. So giving a simple example, if your internal hard drive is 1 terabyte, and that's the only thing you're going to put in your Time Machine, then get a 2 terabyte external hard drive. If you're going to back up your internal drive at 1 terabyte and an external drive that's 1 terabyte, so you have 2 terabytes total, get at least 4 terabytes of storage. And the more, the better. The larger drive you get, the further back in that Time Machine history you're going to be able to go. But also, don't rely on the fact that you're always going to have that Time Machine history. It's not intended to be what I call an archive backup. And the difference, or an archive, let's not even call it a backup, let's call it an archive. And the difference in my mind between a backup and an archive is a backup is there to recover you immediately should you have some sort of failure. So to get back up and running with the same data and information you had at the time you had your catastrophic event, right? That is what a backup is for. An archive is files and data that you want to have preserved for forever. Stuff that you can go back to 10 years from now and recover and get back, regardless of whether or not it is on your local system or wherever it's stored, you can go back and get that. So you really need to, in my mind, think about those two things differently. And the ability to go back and get older versions or deleted files, you know, really needs to come in and fall on that archive area. So if you're in your computer and you know your computer's being backed up and you're deciding, you know what, here's this project I've been working on for a client. It's got all his video files. It's a video project. It's got all the email information we've been going back forth, notes and all those sorts of things. I don't really want that on my internal hard drive anymore because I'm done with that project. You're going to take that. You're going to save it off onto a USB stick or an external hard drive or some sort of other format. That's an archive. And if it's really important, you're going to want to have it in, again, more than one location. Don't just put it on one USB thumb drive. Maybe consider buying 2 USB thumb drives. Put that on there. Put a label on each one. Maybe even move one to an offsite location to keep it secure. Again, it depends on how important that archive is. And remember, you know, data doesn't always last forever either. You know, what happens if USB ports go away 10 years in the future? Now you have a USB stick, but no way to plug it in or connect it to your computer. You can get to that point. So remember, with archives, very often you're going to have to do format shifting. I have a bunch of stuff that's on, you know, CDRs that I know I've been putting it off, but I know if I want to continue to have access to that, I need to move that to some other storage medium, because guess what? I think I have one computer in my house now that has a CD-ROM drive. And of course, I probably could buy a USB one still, but how long is that going to happen? You know, think about VHS tapes that you might have. Do you have a VHS player to play them on? No, formats shift over time. So archive storage, you need to also format shift as years go by, especially if you want to be able to recover that stuff. But we really need to start thinking about archive data differently than our backup data. And you need to back up your archive data if you want to have that. But again, it's just a separate kind of storage. So you have your immediate storage, your daily storage, which is your internal hard drive. You have your backups, which is your thing for recovering from a loss or an event. And then you have your archive storage, which is your long-term data storage. And we often, I think, forget about that long-term data storage. And we assume that backups are going to be the solution for that, but they really are not. So I wanted to bring that topic up because I just hate hearing these stories when someone says, I lost a bunch of data because I didn't have it in my backup. I had deleted it 4 months ago. I went to Time Machine and Time Machine only went back 3 months. And so now it's lost for forever and I didn't create an archive of it. So just need to understand that issue and make sure that we're not running into that. And in case you're wondering how I do some of my archiving or how I separate it, you know, you really have to identify that important stuff, that stuff that you do want to archive. And then once you've done that, you need to come up with some sort of strategy for it. I mentioned you using USB drives. You could get a little hard drive toaster, like I've recommended in the past. This is an external USB box that allows you to plug in bare hard drives that you can buy. So if you need, you know, a 1 terabyte external hard drive, might cost you 70, 80 bucks at this point. You can dock that in, archive your files off onto that, eject it, and then set that on a shelf. But again, remember, it's a spinning hard drive. It's not going to last forever. You might want to actually do two of them just in case, that sort of thing. In my case, the thing that I use most frequently for what I call immediate archive storage, not long-term, is I have a couple Drobos that have multiple drives in them, so they have their own built-in data redundancy. And then I use the application called ChronoSync, and I have a bunch of automated jobs set up that go through every night when I'm sleeping and grab my most important files and archive those for me. And those are things like my podcast files. So all of my original GarageBand files and recordings, everything I use to make each episode of the MacCast, those all get archived. I have client files for my web development work. Those all get archived over to my Drobo, my iTunes media files, and my photo libraries. You know, I never want to lose my photo library. I have photo libraries, copies of them, I believe, realistically, in at least 6 places between archive backups, regular backups, iCloud storage, and all of that. My photos are in 6 different places, 7, I think, because I actually do an archive also to my Flickr account. So I have 7 copies of every photo that I've ever taken in my library. I know it's extreme, but those are things that I never, ever want to lose. I don't want to lose that data. And so a nice thing about ChronoSync, too, is that you can choose an option when you're synchronizing. So the, basically, the way it works is you can define a folder, and I tell it to sync that folder over to a location on my Drobo. And that script runs every night. It has an option that says do not sync deletions. And this is great for things like my iTunes media files or my photo libraries, because what will happen is if I delete something in there, even though it's syncing back over to the Drobo, it will not synchronize that deletion, which means that copy stays as an archive in that backup. And it's really, really great. And then in addition to all of that, I also create one-off archives of various project files, folders. Again, either in the old days, it used to be to a CDR. More and more these days, it's to an external hard drive that I pop into my little toaster here and do that. Or sometimes it's just a matter of copying them off to a network attached storage drive. I also have a Synology that I copy and store and archive some stuff on. And then that gets backed up to cloud storage. So those are some of my strategies. You kind of need to make this thing really personal. But the point is, in addition to having a backup strategy, I know I harp on you about that all the time, I'm going to start harping on you on having an archive storage system or procedure for some of your stuff. And I'd love to know, if you're doing your own archival storage, how are you managing it? What are you doing? What are your some of your tips and tricks? Please share those with us, maccast@gmail.com. And I think I had said this was going to be our last thing to talk about. I actually have one more thing, and this is kind of cool. This is a podcast thing. And I know Apple's podcast app takes a lot of heat. It gets a lot of flack because Apple's been really changing it radically over the years. And in its current iteration, a lot of people really hate it. And I've recommended third-party podcast apps. There's a lot of great ones out there. Downcast is one of my favorites. I know Castro is out there. I know tons of people who love Overcast. And that's great. All of those applications are really great. They all have great features depending upon what you want to do with podcasts. But I often get emails and get a lot of flack and hear from a lot of people who are frustrated over the years by the changes that Apple's made to Apple's podcast app. And one of the biggest complaints I hear about is the loss and ability to create playlists and smart playlists to manage your podcasts. And that went away when Apple removed podcasts from iTunes and moved them into its own app. So in iOS 11, this has dramatically changed in recent years. And Wayne wrote in and was talking about the loss of the playlist feature and how much it frustrated him, and also the loss of the ability to kind of archive and save podcasts that he might want to keep for later listening or for just down the road, almost like archiving podcasts. And I was thinking about this and I thought, yeah, that is kind of frustrating, Wayne. You know, you're absolutely right. But then I thought, you know, I wonder, I don't delve that deep into the podcast app. I haven't done it in a while. Typically, I go in, I subscribe, and then I just find the show that I want to listen to, and I press play, and I listen to it. And it works great. It works fine for me. It syncs, you know, so I often use it in the car and all that sort of stuff. And I hadn't really thought about more kind of daily management and what happens if I want to mix and match podcasts. I want to create my own podcast playlist, and I maybe want to rearrange the order of that stuff and control how I'm listening to things. You know, playlists allowed us to do that. I can't imagine that, you know, the podcast app has totally done away with that. But so many people have told me that I just kind of assumed, okay, well, you know, that stinks. Well, I went in and I got looking, and I started to play around with a feature in there called Stations. And guess what? It's not a full replacement for playlists, but in a lot of ways, Stations is pretty much like playlists for podcasts, and it's built right into the podcast app. I hadn't really messed with it. I started playing with it, and here's sort of what I found. So you can access Stations from the Library tab in iOS. So open up the podcast app, tap on your library, tap Edit, and then you'll see a Create New Station button. Tap on that, and then you can give your station a title, just like a playlist. So name it whatever you want. You might want to put things around categories. So maybe you have like technology podcasts and comedy podcasts and whatever you're into, you know, history podcasts. You could create separate categories for that. And then you tap save. And so you create a new station for each one of those. And then once you have the station, you tap on the station, and you have some options that you can play around with. There is a play section where you can control the play order of that station. So you can do it in manual show order. You can do it with the oldest episodes first or the newest episodes first. Or you can even choose to do it completely manually where you hand sort all of the episodes that go in there. You can group things by show, or you can just leave them as a big list of mixed shows if you want. You can set the number of episodes inside a station to be added. So things like only the latest episode from each podcast you have in your station, or the last three episodes from each podcast you have in your station. You can filter by media type. So if you want to make sure that only audio podcasts go into that station or only video podcasts go into that station, you can do that. And, then you can choose the podcasts that are in that station mix. So there's a little choose podcast thing. You tap that and you put in, say, all of your technology podcasts. So I played around with this. I set up one for my favorite podcasts, and I said, put the latest three episodes of each one into this station, and I'm going to call it my podcast favorites station. And then once I was in there, it was really cool because the stations sync via iCloud. So once I set it up on my iPad Pro, the same stations were on my Mac and the same stations were on my iOS device. And then in there, I could tap play on my stations and it would go through and play them. And I could go in and tweak the settings and reorder them. And I really think that's kind of what you're looking for, maybe in terms of playlists, at least when it comes to podcasts. I know, again, it's not all of the features, but that may help you out. And there was kind of another cool feature I discovered, not directly related to stations, but just related to playing podcasts and looking at the podcast details, and that is the Up Next list, which I didn't know was there, but actually Wayne wrote back and reminded me, hey, if you're on the little player sheet, so you're in playing a podcast, and you tap on the player sheet, so tap on the podcast on the bottom to bring up the player sheet with the player controls and the episode details, if you swipe up, at the bottom of that list is the Up Next list, which is the list of what podcasts would be coming up. So if you started listening to a podcast inside, say, just podcasts instead of episodes, you're going to see the next available episodes for that podcast. But what you can do is you can browse around. You can go into your library, look up other podcasts and other episodes, and on the detail screen for those episodes, if you tap the little dot, 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 the ellipsis button, ellipses, I always get that word wrong, let's call it dot, 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 hit the dot, 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 and then click on details, and it will bring up some options And one of those options is play next. So you can say, as you're listening to a podcast, hey, this is the next podcast that I want to listen to. Add this to my up next list. And once you have a few in there, you'll also see when you tap on that, and you can also force press on an episode to bring up this option. You'll see a play later option. So play next will make it the next immediate podcast after the current one you're listening to, kind of add it to the top of the list. And if you hit play later, it will add it to the very bottom of the list. And so once they're in the list, when you go back into the player sheet and you swipe up, you actually have little handles and you can control the sort order of your up next list. So this is kind of a way to maybe make an on the fly playlist in a sort of way. And you can control the order and decide which episodes you want coming up next as you're listening to them. And then the last thing that Wayne was asking about was the ability to actually save episodes, to kind of archive episodes that you might want to come back to later. Again, that feature is in there. All you have to do is when you're listening to an episode, tap the little dot, dot, dot button again, and then tap the save episode option. And then later, when you go back to your library and tap on that show, you should see a saved episodes section, and you can save episodes for each show. Again, if you tap on the dot, dot, dot button while you're playing an episode, and if it's already been saved, it's already a saved episode, you can tap the button again to remove it, and then it'll give you the option. It'll say, do you want to remove this actually from your library, or do you want to remove it just from the saved list? And you can just remove it from your saved episodes. So all of those features are in there. They're a little bit more hidden, maybe a little bit more tricky to get to than they were in the past. But there's actually kind of a lot of cool features inside the podcast app. And I realized we hadn't covered that very much on the MacCast. So there's a couple little bits of information for you. If you know more tips and tricks related to Apple's podcast app and you want to share those with us, please do send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for the MacCast for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen Disk Label, also Text Expander for iOS, and PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can find more information and details on all of their great applications by going to smilesoftware.com/podcasts. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com, and all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. You'll find them at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love getting comments from you. You know, the community is how the MacCast works. I need your questions, your comments to kind of drive the content of the show. So if you have an idea for a topic, if you have a question about something, even if you just have a comment on a past episode, send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you want to follow me on social media between shows, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or check out the MacCast Google Plus community. That's at google.com/PlusMacCast. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.